A New English Course, 6, Students' Book, Unit 1, Text 1. Two Words to Avoid, Two to Remember, by Arthur Gordon. Text. Nothing in life is more exciting and rewarding than the sudden flash of insight that leaves you a changed person, not only changed, but changed for the better. Such moments are rare, certainly, but they come to all of us, sometimes from a book, a sermon, a line of poetry, sometimes from a friend. That wintry afternoon in Manhattan, waiting in the little French restaurant, I was feeling frustrated and depressed. Because of several miscalculations on my part, a project of considerable importance in my life had fallen through. Even the prospect of seeing a dear friend, the old man as I privately and affectionately thought of him, failed to cheer me as it usually did. I sat there frowning at the checkered tablecloth, chewing the bitter cud of hindsight. He came across the street finally, muffled in his ancient overcoat, shapeless felt hat pulled down over his bald head, looking more like an energetic gnome than an eminent psychiatrist. His offices were nearby. I knew he had just left his last patient of the day. He was close to 80, but he still carried a full caseload, still acted as director of a large foundation, still loved to escape to the golf course whenever he could. By the time he came over and sat beside me, the waiter had brought his invariable bottle of ale. I had not seen him for several months, but he seemed as indestructible as ever. "Well, young man," he said without preliminary, "what's troubling you?" I had long since ceased to be surprised at his perceptiveness, so I proceeded to tell him at some length just what was bothering me. With a kind of melancholy pride, I tried to be very honest. I blamed no one else for my disappointment, only myself. I analyzed the whole thing, all the bad judgments, the false moves. I went on for perhaps 15 minutes while the old man sipped his ale in silence. When I finished, he put down his glass. "Come on," he said, "let's go back to my office."
"Your office? Did you forget something?"
"No," he said mildly, "I want your reaction to something, that's all." A chill rain was beginning to fall outside, but his office was warm and comfortable and familiar. Book-lined walls, long leather couch, signed photograph of Sigmund Freud, tape recorder by the window. His secretary had gone home. We were alone. The old man took a tape from a flat cardboard box and fitted it onto the machine. "On this tape," he said, "are three short recordings made by three persons who came to me for help. They are not identified, of course. I want you to listen to the recordings and see if you can pick out the two-word phrase that is the common denominator in all three cases." He smiled. "Don't look so puzzled. I have my reasons." What the owners of the voices on the tape had in common, it seemed to me, was unhappiness. The man who spoke first evidently had suffered some kind of business loss or failure. He berated himself for not having worked harder, for not having looked ahead. The woman who spoke next had never married because of a sense of obligation to her widowed mother. She recalled bitterly all the marital chances she had let go by. The third voice belonged to a mother whose teenage son was in trouble with the police. She blamed herself endlessly. The old man switched off the machine and leaned back in his chair. 6 times in those recordings, a phrase is used that's full of subtle poison. Did you spot it?
No.
Well, perhaps that's because you used it 3 times yourself down in the restaurant a little while ago.
He picked up the box that had held the tape and tossed it over to me.
There they are, right on the label. The two saddest words in any language.
I looked down. Printed neatly in red ink were the words, "If only."
"You'd be amazed," said the old man, "if you knew how many thousands of times I've sat in this chair and listened to woeful sentences beginning with those two words, 'If only,' they say to me, 'I had done it differently, or not done it at all.' 'If only I hadn't lost my temper,' said the cruel thing, made that dishonest move, told that foolish lie. 'If only I had been wiser, or more unselfish, or more self-controlled.' They go on and on and on until I stop them. Sometimes I make them listen to the recordings you just heard. 'If only,' I say to them, 'you'd stop saying, if only, we might begin to get somewhere.'"
The old man stretched out his legs. "The trouble with 'if only,'" he said, "is that it doesn't change anything. It keeps the person facing the wrong way, backward instead of forward. It wastes time. In the end, if you let it become a habit, it can become a real roadblock, an excuse for not trying anymore. Now, take your own case. Your plans didn't work out. Why? Because you made certain mistakes. Well, that's all right. Everyone makes mistakes. Mistakes are what we learn from. But when you were telling me about them, lamenting this, regretting that, you weren't really learning from them."
"How do you know?" I said, a bit defensively.
"Because," said the old man, "you never got out of the past tense. Not once did you mention the future, and in a way, be honest now, you were enjoying it. There's a perverse streak in all of us that makes us all like to hash over old mistakes. After all, when you relate the story of some disaster or disappointment that had happened to you, you're still the chief character, still in the center of the stage."
I shook my head ruefully. "Well, what's the remedy?"
"Shift the focus," said the old man promptly. "Change the key words and substitute a phrase that supplies lift instead of creating drag. Do you have such a phrase to recommend?"
"Certainly."
"Strike out the words, 'if only,' substitute the phrase, 'next time.'"
"Next time?"
"That's right. I've seen it work minor miracles right here in this room. As long as a patient keeps saying, 'if only,' to me, he's in trouble. But when he looks me in the eye and says, 'next time,' I know he's on his way to overcoming his problem. It means he has decided to apply the lessons he has learned from his experience, however grim or painful it may have been. It means he's going to push aside the roadblock of regret, move forward, take action, resume living. Try it yourself. You'll see." My old friend stopped speaking. Outside, I could hear the rain whispering against the window pane. I tried sliding one phrase out of my mind and replacing it with the other. It was fanciful, of course, but I could hear the new words lock into place with an audible click. The old man stood up a bit stiffly. "Well, class dismissed. It has been good to see you, young man. Always is. Now, if you will help me find a taxi, I probably should be getting on home." We came out of the building into the rainy night. I spotted a cruising cab and ran toward it, but another pedestrian was quicker. "My, my," said the old man slyly. "If only we had come down 10 seconds sooner, we'd have caught that cab, wouldn't we?" I laughed and picked up the cue. "Next time, I'll run faster." "That's it," cried the old man, pulling his absurd hat down around his ears. "That's it, exactly." Another taxi slowed. I opened the door for him.
He smiled and waved as it moved away. I never saw him again. A month later, he died of a sudden heart attack, in full stride, so to speak. More than a year has passed since that rainy afternoon in Manhattan. But to this day, whenever I find myself thinking, if only, I change it to next time. Then I wait for that almost perceptible mental click, and when I hear it, I think of the old man. A small fragment of immortality, to be sure, but it's the kind he would have wanted.
Text 2, The Romance of Words by Wilfred Funk and Norman Lewis. From now on, we want you to look at words intently, to be inordinately curious about them, and to examine them syllable by syllable, letter by letter. They are your tools of understanding and self-expression. Collect them, keep them in condition, learn how to handle them. Develop a fastidious, but not a fussy, choice. Work always towards good taste in their use. Train your ear for their harmonies. We urge you not to take words for granted just because they have been part of your daily speech since childhood. You must examine them. Turn them over and over and see the seal and superscription on each one, as though you were handling a coin. We would like you, actually, to fall in love with words. Words, as you know, are not dead things. They are fairly wriggling with life. They are the exciting and mysterious tokens of our thoughts. And like human beings, they are born, come to maturity, grow old and die. And sometimes they are even reborn in a new age. A word, from its birth to its death, is a process, not a static thing. Words, like living trees, have roots, branches and leaves. Shall we stay with this analogy for a few moments and see how perfect it is? The story of the root of a word is the story of its origin. The study of origins is called etymology, which in turn has its roots in the Greek word etymon, meaning true, and the Greek ending logia, meaning knowledge. So, etymology means the true knowledge of words. Every word in our language is a frozen metaphor, a frozen picture. It is this poetry behind words that gives language its overwhelming power. And the more intimately we know the romance that lies within each word, the better understanding we will have of its meaning. For instance, on certain occasions, you will probably say that you have calculated the cost of something or other. What does this term calculate really mean? Here is the story. Years ago, ancient Romans had an instrument called a hodometer, or road measurer, which corresponds to our modern taximeter. If you had hired a two-wheeled Roman vehicle to ride, say, to the forum, you might have found in the back a tin can with a revolving cover that held a quantity of pebbles. This can was so contrived that each time the wheel turned, the metal cover also revolved and a pebble dropped through a hole into the receptacle below. At the end of your trip, you counted the pebbles and calculated your bill. You see, the Latin word for pebble was calculus, and that's where our word calculate comes from. There are, of course, many words with much simpler histories than this. When you speak of a surplus, for instance, you are merely saying that you have a sur, French for over, plus, French for more, or surplus. That is, you have an over more than you need. Should you be in a snooty mood for the nonce and happen to look at someone rather haughtily, your friends might call you supercilious, a word which comes from the Latin supercilium, meaning that eyebrow you just raised. That person you are so fond of who has become your companion, cum, Latin for with, and panis, Latin for bread, is simply one who eats bread with you. That's all. Again, trumps in bridge is from the French triomphe, or triumph, an old-time game of cards. In modern cards, one suit is allowed to triumph over or to trump the other suits. And still again, in the army, the lieutenant is literally one who takes the place of the captain when the latter is not around. From the French lieu, We use it in lieu of, and tenere, to hold. The captain, in turn, derives from the Latin word caput, head. Colonel comes from columna, the column that he leads. If, by any chance, you would like to twit your friend, the Wall Street broker, just tell him that his professional title came from the Middle English word brocure, or brocher, or one who opens, or broaches, a cask to draw off the wine or liquor. We still employ the same word in the original sense when we say he broached or opened up the subject. The broacher, or broker, became a salesman of wine, then of other things, such as stocks and bonds. These are the roots of words. We next come to the branches. The branches of our language tree are those many groups of words that have grown out from one original root. Let's take an example. The Latin term spectra, which means to see, contains the root spec, and from this one root have sprouted more than 240 English words. We find the root hidden in such words as spectacles, those things you see through. In respect, the tribute you give to a person you care to see again. Inspect, to see into. Disrespect, dis, unwilling. Re, again. Spec, to see. Therefore, when you treat someone with disrespect, you make it plain that you do not care to see him again. Introspection, looking or seeing within. Spectator, one who sees or watches. Turning to the Greek language, which has so largely enriched our own, we discover the root appearing in English as graph. This means to write, and has been a prolific source of words for us. We have telegraph, which literally means far writing. Phonograph, sound writing. Photograph, light writing. Stenographer, one who does condensed writing. A graphic description, one that is just as clear and effective as though it had been written down. Mimeograph, to write a copy or imitation. We have in our language a host of roots such as these. There is the Latin spira, meaning to blow or breathe, from which we get such English words as inspire, breathe into, expire, breathe out, perspire, breathe through, respiration, breathing again or often. And there is also our word liable that comes from the Latin ligar, to bind. This fascinating root, lig, has branched out into oblige and obligate, to bind to do something. Ligature, bandage or banding. Ligament, something that ties two things together. And, with the root no longer so obvious, league, those nations or other organisations that are bound together. And even the word ally, which is from ad and ligar, to bind to one another. These, then, are the branches. We turn now to the leaves. If the roots are the origins of words, and the branches are the word families that stem out of them, the leaves of this language tree would be the words themselves and their meanings. Each given word, in its beginning, had, no doubt, only one meaning. But words are so full of life that they are continually sprouting the green shoots of new meanings. Shall we choose just one word as an instance of the amazing vitality of language? The simple three-letter word run, up to this moment of writing, has more than 90 dictionary definitions. There is the run in your stocking, and the run on the bank, and a run in baseball. The clock may run down, but you run up a bill. Colours run. You may run a race or run a business, or you may have the run of the mill, or quite different, the run of the house when you get the run of things. And this little dynamic word, we can assure you, is not yet through with its varied career. Is it any wonder that our unabridged dictionaries contain as many as 600,000 living and usable words? Words sparkling with life, prolific in their breeding, luxuriant in their growth, continually shifting and changing in their meanings. Words even have definite personalities and characters. They can be sweet, sour, discordant, musical. They can be sweet or acrid, soft or sharp, hostile or friendly. From this time on, as we enter our word studies, try to become self-conscious about words. Look at them, if possible, with the fresh eyes of one who is seeing them for the first time. If we have persuaded you to do this, you will then be on the way to the success that can be won with a more powerful vocabulary.
Listening in and speaking out. Reverting to Handwork in a Machine Age by George Orwell. The function of the machine is to save work. In a fully mechanized world, all the dull drudgery will be done by machinery, leaving us free for more interesting pursuits. So expressed, this sounds splendid. It makes one sick to see half a dozen men sweating to dig a trench for a water pipe, when some easily devised machine would scoop the earth out in a couple of minutes. Why not let the machine do the work, and the men go and do something else? But presently, the question arises, what else are they to do? Supposedly, they are set free from work in order that they may do something which is not work. But what is work, and what is not work? Is it work to dig, to carpenter, to plant trees, to fell trees, to ride, to fish, to hunt, to feed chickens, to play the piano, to take photographs, to build a house, to cook, to sew, to trim hats, to mend motor bicycles? All of these things are work to somebody, and all of them are play to somebody. There are, in fact, very few activities which cannot be classed either as work or play, according as you choose to regard them. The laborer, set free from digging, may want to spend his leisure, or part of it, in playing the piano, while the professional pianist may be only too glad to get out and dig at the potato patch. Hence, the antithesis between work as something intolerably tedious and not work as something desirable is false. The truth is that when a human being is not eating, drinking, sleeping, talking, playing games, or merely lounging about, and these things will not fill up a lifetime, he needs work and usually looks for it, though he may not call it work. Cease to use your hands, and you have cut off a huge part of your consciousness. And now consider again those half-dozen men who were digging the trench for the water pipe. A machine has set them free from digging, and they are going to amuse themselves with something else. Carpentering, for instance. But whatever they want to do, they will find that another machine has set them free from that. For in a fully mechanized world, there would be no more need to carpenter, to cook, to mend motor bicycles, etc., than there would be to dig. There is scarcely anything from catching a whale to carving a cherry stone that could not conceivably be done by machinery. The machine would even encroach upon the activities we now class as art. It is doing so already, via the camera and the radio. Mechanize the world as fully as it might be mechanized, and whichever way you turn, there will be some machine cutting you off from the chance of working, that is, of living. So long as the machine is there, one is under an obligation to use it. No one draws water from the well when he can turn on the tap. One sees a good illustration of this in the matter of travel. Everyone who has traveled by primitive methods in an undeveloped country knows that the difference between the kind of travel and modern travel in trains, cars, etc., is the difference between life and death. The person who walks or rides with his baggage, put on a camel or an ox cart, may suffer every kind of discomfort, but at least he is traveling while he is traveling. Whereas for the passenger in an express train or a luxury liner, his journey is a kind of temporary death. And yet, so long as the railways exist, one has got to travel by train, or by car, or airplane. No human being ever wants to do anything in a more awkward way than is necessary. In a world where everything could be done by machinery, everything would be done by machinery. Deliberately to revert to primitive methods, to use archaic tools, to put silly little difficulties in your own way, would be like solemnly sitting down to eat your dinner with stone tools. Revert to handwork in a machine age, and you are back in ye olde tea shop in the Tudor period, 1485 to 1605.